Missing in Action by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longworth. I lost my left hand on Sameter. This is how it occurred. On the 13th day of Sagittar, local calendar, 3 days before the solstice, in the mid-rise district of the city of Urbitane, an itinerant evangelist called Laszlo Mombril was found shuffling aimlessly around the flat roof of a disused tannery, lacking his eyes, his tongue, his nose, and both of his hands. Urbitane is the second city of Sameter, a declining agrochemical planet in the Helican subsector, and it is no stranger to crimes of cruelty and spite brought on by the vicissitudes of neglect and social deprivation afflicting its tightly packed population. But this act of barbarity stood out for two reasons. First, it was no hot-blooded assault or alcohol-fueled manslaughter, but a deliberate and systematic act of brutal, almost ritual mutilation. Second, it was the fourth such crime discovered that month. I had been on Sameter for just 3 weeks, investigating the links between a bonded trade federation and a secessionist movement on Hesperus at the request of Lord Inquisitor Rorkan. The links proved to be nothing. Urbitane's economic slough had forced the Federation to chase unwise business with unscrupulous shipmasters, and the real meat of the case lay on Hesperus. But I believe this was the Lord Inquisitor's way of gently easing me back into active duties following the long and arduous affair of the Necrotuke. By the Imperial calendar, it was 241.M41, late in that year. I had just finished several self-imposed months of recuperation, meditation, and study on Thracian Primaris. The eyes of the demon host Cherubael still woke me some nights, and I wore permanent scars from torture at the hands of the sadist, Gorgon Locke. His Strucine neural scourge had damaged my nervous system and paralyzed my face. I would not smile again for the rest of my life. But the battle wounds sustained on KCX 1288 and 56 Izar had healed, and I was now itching to renew my work. This idle task on Sameter had suited me, so I had taken it and closed the dossier after a swift and efficient investigation. But latterly, as I prepared to leave, officials of the Munitorum unexpectedly requested an audience. I was staying with my associates in a suite of rooms in the Urbitane Excelsior, a shabby but well-appointed establishment in the high-rise district of the city. Through soot-stained, armoured roundels of glass 20 meters across, the suite looked out across the filthy grey towers of the city to the brackish waters of the polluted bay 20 kilometers away. Ornithopters and biplanes buzzed between the massive city structures, and the running lights of freighters and orbitals glowed in the smog as they swung down towards the landing port. Out on the isthmus, through a haze of yellow, stagnant air, Promethean refineries belched brown smoke into the perpetual twilight. "They're here," said Beckwin, entering the suite's lounge from the outer lobby. She had dressed in a demure gown of blue damask and a silk pashmina, perfectly in keeping with my instruction that we should present a muted but powerful image. I myself was clad in a suit of soft black linen, with a waistcoat of grey velvet and a hip-length black leather storm coat.
"Do you need me for this?"
asked Midas Betancourt, my pilot and confidant. I shook my head. "I don't intend to be delayed here. I just have to be polite. Go on to the landing port and make sure the gun cutter's readied for departure." He nodded and left. Beckwin showed the visitors in. I had felt it necessary to be polite, because Eskeen Hansard, Urbitane's Minister of Security, had come to see me himself. He was a massive man in a double-breasted brown tunic, his big frame offset oddly by his finely featured, boyish face. He was escorted by two bodyguards in grey, armour-ribbed uniforms and a short but handsome black-haired woman in a dark blue body glove. I had made sure I was sitting in an armchair when Beckwin showed them in, so I could rise in a measured, respectful way. I wanted them to be in no doubt who was really in charge here. "Minister Hansard," I said, shaking his hand. "I am Inquisitor Gregor Eisenhorn of the Ordo Xenos. These are my associates, Elizabeth Beckwin, Arbites Chastener Godwin Fischig, and Savant Uber Amos. How may I help you?"
"I have no wish to waste your time, Inquisitor," he said, apparently nervous in my presence.
That was good, just as I had intended it.
A case has been brought to my attention that I believe is beyond the immediate purview of the city arbites. Frankly, it smacks of warp corruption, and cries out for the attention of the Inquisition.
He was direct. That impressed me. A ranking official of the Imperium, anxious to be seen to be doing the right thing. Nevertheless, I still expected his business might be a mere nothing, like the affair of the Trade Federation, a local crime requiring only my nod of approval that it was fine for him to continue in clothes. Men like Hansard are often over-careful, in my experience.
There have been 4 deaths in the city during the last month that we believe to be linked. I would appreciate your advice on them. They are connected by merit of the ritual mutilation involved.
Show me, I said.
Captain,
he responded. Arbites Captain Hurley Rex was the handsome woman with the short black hair. She stepped forward, nodded respectfully, and gave me a data slate with the gold crest of the Adeptus Arbites on it.
I have prepared a digested summary of the facts, she said.
I began to speed-read the slate, already preparing the gentle knockback I was expecting to give to his case. Then I stopped, slowed, read back. I felt a curious mix of elation and frustration. Even from this cursorial glance, there was no doubt this case required the immediate attention of the Imperial Inquisition. I could feel my instincts stiffen and my appetites whetten for the first time in months. In bothering me with this, Minister Hansard was not being over-careful at all. At the same time, my heart sank with the realization that my departure from this miserable city would be delayed. All 4 victims had been blinded and had their noses, tongues, and hands removed, at the very least. The evangelist, Mombril, had been the only one found alive. He had died from his injuries 8 minutes after arriving at Urbitane Mid-Rise Sector Infirmary. It seemed to me likely that he had escaped his ritual tormentors somehow before they could finish their work. The other 3 were a different story.
Pal Graven, a machinesmith. Luthar Hewal, a rugmaker. Idilane Faspel, a midwife.
Hewal had been found a week before by city sanitation servitors during routine maintenance to a soil stack in the Mid-Rise district. Someone had attempted to burn his remains and then flush them into the city's ancient waste system, but the human body is remarkably durable. The post could not prove his missing body parts had not simply succumbed to decay and been flushed away, but the damage to the ends of the forearm bones seemed to speak convincingly of a saw or chain blade. When Idilane Faspel's body was recovered from a crawl space under the roof of a mid-rise tenement hab, it threw more light on the extent of Hewal's injuries. Not only had Faspel been mutilated in the manner of the evangelist Mombril, but her brain, brainstem, and heart had been excised. The injuries were hideous. One of the roof workers who discovered her had subsequently committed suicide. Her bloodless, almost desiccated body, dried out, smoked, if you will, by the tenement's heating vents, had been wrapped in a dark green cloth similar to the material of an Imperial Guard issue bedroll, and stapled to the underside of the rafters with an industrial nail gun. Cross-reference between her and Hewal convinced the Arbites that the rugmaker had very probably suffered the removal of his brainstem and heart too. Until that point, they had ascribed the identifiable lack of those soft organs to the almost toxic levels of organic decay in the liquescent filth of the soil stack. Graven, actually the first victim found, had been dredged from the waters of the bay by salvage ship. He had been presumed to be a suicide dismembered by the screws of a passing boat, until Rex's careful cross-checking had flagged up too many points of similarity. Because of the peculiar circumstances of their various post-mortem locations, it was pathologically impossible to determine any exact date or time of death. But Rex could be certain of a window. Graven had been last seen on the 19th of Aquiare, 3 days before his body had been dredged up. Hewal had delivered a finished rug to a high-rise customer on the 24th, and had dined that same evening with friends at a charcoot in Midrise. Faspel had failed to report for work on the 5th of Sagittar, although the night before she had seemed happy and looking forward to her next shift, according to friends.
"I thought at first we might have a serial predator loose in Midrise," said Rex. "But the pattern of mutilation seems to me more extreme than that. This is not feral murder, or even psychopathic, post-slaying depravity. This is specific, purposeful, ritual."
How do you arrive at that? Asked my colleague, Fischig. Fischig was a senior arbites from Hubris, with plenty of experience in murder cases. Indeed, it was his fluency with procedure and familiarity with modus operandi that had convinced me to make him a part of my band. That, and his ferocious strength in a fight. Rex looked sidelong at him, as if he was questioning her ability.
Because of the nature of the dismemberment. Because of the way the remains were disposed of.
She looked at me.
In my experience, Inquisitor, a serial killer secretly wants to be found, and certainly wants to be known. It will display its kills with wanton openness, declaring its power over the community. It thrives on the terror and fear it generates. Great efforts were made to hide these bodies. That suggests to me the killer was far more interested in the deaths themselves than in the reaction to the deaths.
Well put, Captain, I said. That has been my experience, too. Cult killings are often hidden so that the cult can continue its work without fear of discovery.
Suggesting that there are other victims still to find,
said Beckwin casually, a chilling prophecy, as it now seems to me.
Cult killings, said the minister. I brought this to your attention because I feared as much. But do you really think? On Alphax, the warp cult removed their victims' hands and tongues because they were organs of communication, Amos began. On Bretaria, the brains were scooped out in order for the cult to ingest the spiritual matter, the anima, as you might say, of their prey. A number of other worlds have suffered cult predations where the eyes have been forfeit. Gullinglass, Pentari, Hesperus, Messina, windows of the soul, you see. The heretics of Saint Scarif, in fact, severed their ritual victims' hands and then made them write out their last confessions using ink quills rammed into the stumps of—
Enough information, Amos, I said. The minister was looking pale. These are clearly cult killings, sir, I said. There is a noxious cell of chaos at liberty in your city, and I will find it. I went at once to the Mid-Rise district. Grievan, Hewal, and Faspel had all been residents of that part of Urbitane, and Mombril, though a visitor to the metropolis, had been found there too. Amos went to the Munitorum record spire in High-Rise to search the local archives. I was particularly interested in historical cult activity on Sameter, and on date significance. Fischig, Beckwin, and Rex accompanied me. The genus loci of a place can often say much about the crimes committed therein. So far, my stay on Sameter had only introduced me to the cleaner, high-altitude regions of Urbitane's High-Rise, up above the smog cover. Mid-Rise was a dismal, wretched place of neglect and poverty. A tarry resin of pollution coated every surface, and acid rain poured down unremittingly. Raw-engined traffic crawled nose to tail down the poorly lit streets, and the very stone of the buildings seemed to be rotting. The smoggy darkness of Mid-Rise had a red, firelit quality, the backwash of the flares from giant gas processors. It reminded me of picture-slate engravings of the Inferno. We stepped from Rex's armored speeder at the corner of Shearing Street and Pentecost. The captain pulled on her arbites helmet and a quilted flak coat. I began to wish for a hat of my own or a rebreather mask. The rain stank like urine. Every 30 seconds or so, an express flashed past on the elevated trackway, shaking the street.
In here, Rex called, and led us through a shutter off the thoroughfare into the dank hallway of a tenement hab.
Everything was stained with centuries of grime. The heating had been set too high, perhaps to combat the murky wetness outside, but the result was simply an overwhelming humidity and a smell like the fur of a mangy canine. This was Idilane Faspel's last resting place. She'd been found in the roof.
"Where did she live?" asked Fischig. 2 streets away. She had a parlour on one of the old court habs. "He well?" His hab about 1 kilometer west. His remains were found 5 blocks east.
I looked at the data slate. The tannery where Mombril had been found was less than 30 minutes' walk from here, and Graven's home a short tram ride. The only thing that broke the geographical focus of these lives and deaths was the fact that Graven had been dumped in the bay.
"It hasn't escaped my notice that they all inhabited a remarkably specific area," Rex smiled.
I never thought it had, but remarkably is the word. It isn't just the same quarter or district. It's an intensely close network of streets. A neighborhood.
Suggesting? Asked Beckwin.
The killer or killers are local too, said Fischig.
Or someone from elsewhere has a particular hatred of this neighborhood and comes into it to do his or her killing, said Rex.
Like a hunting ground,
noted Fischig. I nodded. Both possibilities had merit. Look around, I told Fischig and Beckwin, well aware that Rex's officers had already been all over the building. But she said nothing. Our expert appraisal might turn up something different. I found a small office at the end of the entrance hall. It was clearly the cubbyhole of the habitat's superintendent. Sheaves of paper were pinned to the flakboard wall. Rental dockets, maintenance rosters, notes of resident complaints. There was a box tray of lost property, a partially disassembled mini-servitor in a tub of oil, a stale stink of cheap liquor. A faded ribbon and paper rosette from an imperial shrine was pinned over the door with a regimental rank stud.
What are you doing in here?
I looked round. The superintendent was a middle-aged man in a dirty overall suit. Details. I always look for details. The gold signet ring with the wheatear symbol. The row of permanent metal sutures, closing the scar on his scalp where the hair had never grown back. The prematurely weathered skin. The guarded look in his eyes. I told him who I was, and he didn't seem impressed. Then I asked him who he was, and he said,
The super. What are you doing in here?
I used my will, sparingly. The psychic gift sometimes closes as many doors as it opens, but there was something about this man. He needed a jolt.
What is your name?
I asked, modulating my voice to carry the full weight of the psychic probe. He rocked backwards, and his pupils dilated in surprise.
Quater Traves, he mumbled.
Did you know the midwife, Faspel?
I've seen her around.
To speak to? He shook his head. His eyes never left mine. Did she have friends? He shrugged. What about strangers? Anyone been hanging around the hab? His eyes narrowed. A sullen, mocking look, as if I hadn't seen the streets outside. Who has access to the roof space where her body was found?
Ain't nobody been up there. Not since the place been built. Then the heating packs in, and the contractors has to break through the roof to get up there. They found her.
There isn't a hatch.
Shutter. Locked. And no one has a key. Easier to go through the plasterboard.
Outside, we sheltered from the rain under the elevated railway.
That's what Traves told me, too, Rex confirmed. No one had been into the roof for years until the contractors broke their way in.
Someone had. Someone with the keys to the shutter. The killer. The soil stack where Hewell had been found was behind a row of commercial properties built into an ancient skin of scaffolding that cased the outside of a toolfitter's workshop like a cobweb. The soil stack where Hewell had been found was behind a row of commercial properties built into an ancient skin of scaffolding that cased the outside of a toolfitter's workshop like a cobweb. There was what seemed to be a bar two stages up, where a neon sign flicked between an imperial aquila and a fleur-de-lis. Fischig and Rex continued up to the next scaffolding level to peer in through the stained windows of the habs there. Beckwin and I went into the bar. The light was grey inside. At a high bar, four or five drinkers sat on ratchet stools and ignored us. The scent of obscura smoke was in the air. There was a woman behind the counter who took exception to us from the moment we came in. She was in her 40s, with a powerful, almost masculine build. Her vest was cut off at the armpits, and her arms were as muscular as Fischig's. There was the small tattoo of a skull and crossbones on her bicep. The skin of her face was weathered and coarse.
"Help you?"
she asked, wiping the counter with a glass cloth. As she did so, I saw that her right arm, from the elbow down, was a prosthetic.
"Information," I said.
She flicked her cloth at the row of bottles on the shelves behind her.
"Not a brand I know."
"You know a man called Hewell?"
"No."
"The guy they found in the waste pipes behind here."
"Oh. Didn't know he had a name."
Now I was closer, I could see the tattoo on her arm wasn't a skull and crossbones. It was a wheatear. "We all have names. What's yours?"
"I'm in Lund,"
You live around here?
Live is too strong a word.
She turned away to serve someone else.
Scary bitch, said Beckwin, as we went outside. Everyone acts like they've got something to hide.
Everyone does, even if it's simply how much they hate this town. The heart had gone out of Urbitane, out of Sameter itself, about 70 years before. The mill hives of Thracian Primaris eclipsed Sameter's production, and export profits fell away. In an effort to compete, the authorities freed the refineries to escalate production by stripping away the legal restrictions on atmospheric pollution levels. For hundreds of years, Urbitane had had problems controlling its smog and air pollutants. For the last few decades, it hadn't bothered any more. My Vox earplug chimed. It was Amos. What have you found?
It's most perturbatory. Sameter has been clear of taint for a goodly while. The last inquisitorial investigation was 31 years ago standard, and that wasn't here in Urbitane, but in Aquitaine, the capital. A rogue psyker. The planet has its fair share of criminal activity, usually narcotics trafficking and the consequential mob fighting, but nothing really markedly heretical.
Nothing with similarities to the ritual methods?
No, and I've gone back 2 centuries.
What about the dates?
Sagittar 13th is just shy of the solstice, but I can't make any meaning out of that. The purge of the Sarbatal Hives is usually commemorated by upswings of cult activity in the subsector, but that's 6 weeks away. The only other thing I can find is that this Sagittar 5th was the 21st anniversary of the Battle of Clodeshi Heights.
I don't know it.
The 6th of 7 full-scale engagements during the 16-month Imperial campaign on Surialis 6.
Surialis? That's in the next damn subsector. Amos, every day of the year is the anniversary of any Imperial action somewhere. What connection are you making?
The 9th Sameter Infantry saw service in the war on Surialis.
Fishig and Rex had rejoined us from their prowl around the upper stages of the scaffolding. Rex was talking on her own vox set. She signed off and looked at me, rain drizzling off her visor.
They've found another one, Inquisitor, she said.
It wasn't one. It was 3. And their discovery threw the affair wide open. An old warehouse in the mill zone, 10 streets away from Faspel's Hab, had been damaged by fire 2 months before, and now the municipal work crews had moved in to tear it down and reuse the lot as a site for cheap prefab habitat blocks. They'd found the bodies behind the wall insulation in a mouldering section untouched by the fire. A woman and 2 men, systematically mutilated in the manner of the other victims. But these were much older. I could tell that even at a glance. I crunched across the debris littering the floor space of the warehouse shell. Rain streamed in through the roof holes, illuminated as a blizzard of white specks by the cold blue beams of the Arbites floodlights shining into the place. Arbites officers were all around, but they hadn't touched the discovery itself. Mummified and shriveled, these fetally curled, pitiful husks had been in the wall a long time. What's that? I asked. Fishig leaned forward for a closer look.
Adhesive tape, wrapped around them to hold them against the partition. Old. The gums decayed.
That pattern on it. The silver flecks.
I think it's military issue stuff. Matte silver coating. You know the sort. The coating's coming off with age.
These bodies are different ages, I said.
I thought so too, said Fishig.
We had to wait 6 hours for a preliminary report from the District Examiner Medicae, but it confirmed our guess. All 3 bodies had been in the wall for at least 8 years, and then for different lengths of time. Decompositional anomalies showed that one of the males had been in position for as much as 12 years. The other 2 added subsequently, at different occasions. No identifications had yet been made.
The warehouse was last used 6 years ago, Rex told me.
I want a roster of workers employed there before it went out of business. Someone using the same MO and the same spools of adhesive tape had hidden bodies there over a period of years. The disused tannery where poor Mombril had been found stood at the junction between Xerxes Street and a row of slum tenements known as the Pilings. It was a fetid place, with the stink of the lye and coruscutum used in the tanning process still pungent in the air. No amount of acid rain could wash that smell out.
There were no stairs. Fischig, Beckwin, and I climbed up to the roof via a metal fire ladder. How long does a man survive mutilated like that?
From the severed wrists alone, he'd bleed out in 20 minutes, perhaps, Fischig estimated. Clearly, if he had made an escape, he'd have the adrenaline of terror sustaining him a little.
So, when he was found up here, he can have been no more than 20 minutes from the scene of his brutalization. We looked around. The wretched city looked back at us, close-packed and dense. There were hundreds of possibilities. It might take days to search them all. But we could narrow it down.
How did he get on the roof? I asked.
I was wondering that, said Fischig.
The ladder we came up by.
Beckwin trailed off as she realized her gaffe.
Without hands, Fischig smirked.
Or sight, I finished. Perhaps he didn't escape. Perhaps his abusers put him here.
Or perhaps he fell, Beckwin said, pointing.
The back of a tall warehouse overshadowed the tannery to the east. 10 meters up, there were shattered windows.
If he was in there somewhere, fled blindly, and fell through onto this roof.
Well reasoned, Elizabeth, I said. The Arbetes had done decent work, but not even Rex had thought to consider this inconsistency. We went round to the side entrance of the warehouse. The battered metal shutters were locked. A notice pasted to the wall told would-be intruders to stay out of the property of Hundelmass Agricultural Stowage. I took out my multi-key and disengaged the padlock. I saw Fischig had drawn his sidearm. What's the matter?
I had a feeling just then, like we were being watched.
We went inside. The air was cold and still, and smelled of chemicals. Rows of storage vats filled with chemical fertilizers lined the echoing warehall. The second floor was bare-boarded and hadn't been used in years. Wire mesh had been stapled over a doorway to the next floor, and rainwater dripped down. Fischig pulled at the mesh. It was cosmetic only, and folded aside neatly. Now I drew my auto-pistol, too. On the street side of the third floor, which was divided into smaller rooms, we found a chamber 10 meters by 10, on the floor of which was spread a sheet of plastic, smeared with old blood and other organic deposits. There was a stink of fear.
"This is where they did him," Fischig said with certainty.
"No sign of cult markings or chaos symbology," I mused.
"Maybe not," said Beckwin,
crossing the room, being careful not to step on the smeared plastic sheet. For the sake of her shoes, not the crime scene, I was sure.
"What's this? Something was hung here."
2 rusty hooks in the wall, scraped enough to show something had been hanging there recently. On the floor below was a curious cross drawn in yellow chalk. "I've seen that before somewhere," I said. My vox bleeped. "It was Rex.
I've got that worker, Rusty, you asked for."
"Good. Where are you?"
"Coming to find you at the tannery, if you're still there."
"We'll meet you on the corner of Xerxes Street. Tell your staff we have a crime scene here in the agricultural warehouse." We walked out of the killing room towards the stairwell. Fischig froze and brought up his gun.
"Again?"
I whispered. He nodded and pushed Beckwin into the cover of a door jamb. Silence, apart from the rain and the scurry of vermin. Gun braced, Fischig looked up at the derelict roof. It may have been my imagination, but it seemed as if a shadow had moved across the bare rafters. I moved forward, scanning the shadows with my pistol. Something creaked. A floorboard. Fischig pointed to the stairs. I nodded I understood, but the last thing I wanted was a mistaken shooting. I carefully keyed my vox and whispered,
"Rex, you're not coming into the warehouse to find us, are you?"
"Negative, Inquisitor."
"Stand by."
Fischig had reached the top of the staircase. He peered down, aiming his weapon. Lasfire erupted through the floorboards next to him, and he threw himself flat. I put a trio of shots into the mouth of the staircase, but my angle was bad. 2 hard, round shots spat back up the stairs, and then the roar and flash of the las came again, raking the floor. From above, I realized belatedly. Whoever was on the stairs had a hard slug sidearm, but the lasfire was coming down from the roof. I heard steps running on the floor below. Fischig scrambled up to give chase, but another salvo of lasfire sent him ducking again. I raised my arm and fired up into the roof tiles, blowing out holes through which the pale light poked. Something slithered and scrambled on the roof.
Fischig was on the stairs now, running after the second assailant. I hurried across the third floor, following the sounds of the man on the roof. I saw a silhouette against the sky through a hole in the tiles and fired again. Lazfire replied in a bright burst, but then there was a thump and further slithering.
"Cease fire! Give yourself up! Inquisition!" I bellowed, using the will.
There came a much more substantial crash, sounding like a whole portion of the roof had come down. Tiles avalanched down and smashed in a room nearby. I slammed into the doorway, gun aimed, about to yell out a further will command, but there was no one in the room. Piles of shattered roof slates and bricks covered the floor beneath a gaping hole in the roof itself, and a battered las rifle lay amongst the debris. On the far side of the room were some of the broken windows that Beckwin had pointed out as overlooking the tannery roof. I ran to one. Down below, a powerful figure in dark overalls was running for cover. The killer, escaping from me in just the same way his last victim had escaped him. Through the windows, onto the tannery roof. The distance was too far to use the will again, with any effect, but my aim and angle were good. I lined up on the back of the head a second before it disappeared, began to apply pressure, and the world exploded behind me. I came round, cradled in Beckwin's arms.
"Don't move, Eisenhorn. The medics are coming."
"What happened?"
I asked. "Booby trap.
The gun that guy left behind, it exploded behind you. Power cell overload."
"Did Fischig get his man?"
"Of course he did."
He hadn't, in fact.
He'd chased the man hard, down two flights of stairs and through the main floor of the warehall. At the outer door onto the street, the man had wheeled round and emptied his auto pistol's clip at the chasener, forcing him into cover. Then Captain Rex, approaching from outside, had gunned the man down in the doorway. We assembled in Rex's crowded office in the busy RBT's mid-rise sector house. Amos joined us, laden down with papers and data slates, and brought Midas Betancourt with him.
"You all right?"
Midas asked me.
In his jacket of embroidered cerise silk, he was a vivid splash of colour in the muted gloom of mid-rise.
"Minor abrasions, I'm fine." "I thought we were leaving, and here you are having all the fun without me."
"I thought we were leaving too until I saw this case. Review Beckwin's notes. I need you up to speed."
Amos shuffled his ancient, augmentically assisted bulk over to Rex's desk and dropped his books and papers in an unceremonious pile.
"I've been busy," he said.
"Busy with results?" Beckwin asked. He looked at her sourly.
"No, actually. But I have gathered a commendable resource of information. As the discussion advances, I may be able to fill in blanks."
"No results, Amos. Most perturbatory,"
grinned Midas, his white teeth gleaming against his dark skin. He was mocking the old savant by using Amos's favourite phrase. I had before me the work roster of the warehouse where the three bodies had been found, and another for the agricultural store where our fight had occurred. Quick comparison brought up two coincident names.
"Brel Sadakis, Vim Venick, both worked as warehouse men before the place closed down. Now they're employed by Hundelmass Agricultural Stowage."
"Backgrounds? Addresses?" I asked Rex.
"I ran checks," she said.
"So, we have a cult here, eh?"
Midas asked.
"You've got a series of ritual killings, at least one murder site, and now the names of two possible cultists."
"Perhaps." I wasn't convinced. There seemed both more and less to this than had first appeared. Inquisitorial hunch. The remains of the las rifle discarded by my assailant lay on an evidence tray. Even with the damage done by the overloading power cell, it was apparent that this was an old model.
"Did the power cell overload because it was dropped? It fell through the roof, didn't it?"
Beckwin asked.
"They're pretty solid,"
Fischig answered. "Forced overload," I said. "An old Imperial Guard trick. I've heard they learn how to set one off. As a last ditch in tight spots, cornered, about to die anyway."
"That's not standard,"
said Fischig, poking at the trigger guard of the twisted weapon. His knowledge of guns was sometimes unseemly.
"See this modification? It's been machine-tooled to widen the guard around the trigger."
"Why?" I asked. Fischig shrugged.
"Access?
For an augmetic hand with rudimentary digits?"
We went through to a morgue room down the hall, where the man Rex had gunned down was lying on a slab. He was middle-aged, with a powerful frame going to seed. His skin was weather-beaten and lined.
Identity? We're working on it.
The body had been stripped by the morgue attendants. Fischig scrutinized it, rolling it with Rex's help to study the back. The man's clothes and effects were in plastine bags in a tray at his feet. I lifted the bag of effects and held it up to the light.
"Tattoo," reported Fischig. "Imperial Eagle, left shoulder. Crude. Old. Letters underneath it. Capital S, period. Capital I, period. Capital I. Capital X."
I just found the signet ring in the bag. Gold, with a wheat ear motif.
S-I-I-X, said Amos. Sameter Infantry 9.
The 9th Sameter Infantry had been founded in Urbitane 23 years before, and had served, as Amos had already told me, in the brutal liberation war on Cerealis 6. According to city records, 519 veterans of that war and that regiment had been repatriated to Sameter after mustering out 13 years ago, coming back from the horrors of war to an increasingly depressed world beset by the blight of poverty and urban collapse. Their regimental emblem, as befitted a world once dominated by agriculture, was the wheat ear.
"They came back 13 years ago. The oldest victim we have dates from that time," said Fischig.
"Cerealis 6 was a hard campaign, wasn't it?" I asked. Amos nodded.
"The enemy was dug in. It was ferocious, brutal, brutalizing. And the climate. 2 white dwarf suns, no cloud cover. The most punishing heat and light, not to mention ultraviolet burning."
"Ruins the skin," I murmured. "Makes it weather-beaten and prematurely aged." Everyone looked at the taut, lined face of the body on the slab.
"I'll get a list of the veterans," volunteered Rex. "I already have one," said Amos.
"I'm betting you find the names Brel Sodakis and Vim Venik on it," I said. Amos paused as he scanned.
"I do," he agreed.
"What about Quater Traves?"
"Yes, he's here. Master Gunnery Sergeant Quater Traves."
"What about Omin Lund?"
"Yes, sniper, first class. Invalided out of service."
"The Sameter 9th were a mixed unit, then?" asked Beckwin.
"All our guard foundings are," Rex said proudly.
"So these men, and women," Midas mused. "Soldiers, been through hell, fighting the corruption. Your idea is they brought it back here with them. Some taint. You think they were infected by the touch of the warp on Cerealis, and have been ritually killing as a way of worship back here ever since?"
"No," I said. "I think they're still fighting the war." It remains a sad truth of the Imperium that virtually no veteran ever comes back from fighting its wars intact. Combat alone shreds nerves and shatters bodies. But the horrors of the warp and of foul Xenos forms like the Tyranid steal sanity forever and leave veterans fearing the shadows and the night and, sometimes, the nature of their friends and neighbors for the rest of their lives. The guards of the 9th Sameter Infantry had come home 13 years before, broke by a savage war against mankind's arch-enemy, and, through their scars and their fear, brought the war back with them. The Arbites mounted raids at once on the addresses of all the veterans on the list, those that could be traced, those that were still alive. It appeared that skin cancer had taken over 200 of them in the years since their repatriation. Cerealis had claimed them as surely as if they had fallen there in combat. A number were rounded up, bewildered drunks, cripples, addicts, a few honest men and women trying diligently to carry on with their lives. For those latter I felt especially sorry. But about 70 could not be traced. Many may have disappeared, moved on, or died without it coming to the attention of the authorities. But some had clearly fled. Lund, Traves, Sodakis, Venik, for starters. Their habs were found abandoned, strewn with possessions, as if the occupant had left in a hurry. So were the habs of 20 more belonging to names on the list. The Arbetes arrived at the hab of one, ex-Corporal Geffen Sancto, in time to catch him in the act of flight. Sancto had been a flamer operator in the guard, and like so many of his kind, had managed to keep his weapon as a memento. Screaming the battle cry of the Samiter Ninth, he torched four Arbetes in the stairwell of his building before the tactical squads of the judiciary vaporized him in a hail of gunshots.
"Why are they killing?" Beckwin asked me. "All these years in secret ritual."
"I don't know."
"You do, Eisenhorn. You so do."
"Very well. I can guess. The fellow worker who jokes at the Emperor's expense and makes your fragile sanity imagine he is tainted with the warp. The rug maker whose patterns suggest to you the secret encoding of chaos symbols. The midwife, you decide, is spawning the offspring of the arch-enemy in the mid-rise maternity hall. The travelling evangelist, who seems just too damn fired up to be safe." She looked down at the floor of the landspeeder.
"They see demons everywhere."
"In everything. In everyone. And so help them, they believe they are doing the Emperor's work by killing. They trust no one, so they daren't alert the authorities. They take the eyes, the hands, and the tongue, all the organs of communication, any way the arch-enemy might transmit his foul lies. And then they destroy the brain and heart, the organs which common soldier myth declares must harbor demons."
"So where are we going now?" she asked.
"Another hunch." The guild hall of the Samiter Agricultural Fraternity was a massive ragstone building on Furnace Street, its facade decaying from the ministrations of smog and acid rain. It had been disused for over 2 decades. Its last duty had been to serve as a recruitment post of the Samiter Ninth during the founding. In its long hallways, the men and women of the Ninth had signed their names, collected their starchy new fatigues, and pledged their battle oath to the God Emperor of mankind. At certain times, under certain circumstances, when a proper altar to the Emperor is not available, guard officers improvise in order to conduct their ceremonies. An imperial eagle, an aquila standard, is suspended from a wall, and a sacred spot is marked on the floor beneath in yellow chalk. The guild hall was not a consecrated building. The founding must have been the first time the young volunteers of Urbitane had seen that done. They'd made their vows to a yellow chalk cross and a dangling aquila. Rex was leading 3 fire teams of armed Arbetes, but I went in with Midas and Fishig first, quietly. Beckwin and Amos stayed by our vehicle. Midas was carrying his matched needle pistols, and Fishig an auto shotgun. I clipped a slab pattern magazine full of fresh rounds into the precious bolt pistol given to me by Librarian Britnoth of the Adeptus Astartes Death Watch chapter. We pushed open the boarded doors of the decaying structure and edged down the dank corridors. Rainwater pattered from the roof, and the marble floor was spotted and eaten by collected acid. We could hear the singing. A couple of dozen voices voicing up the battle hymn of the Golden Throne. I led my companions forward, hunched low. Through the crazed windows of an inner door, we looked through into the main hall. 23 disheveled veterans in ragged clothes were knelt down in ranks on the filthy floor, their heads bowed to the rusty imperial eagle hanging on the wall as they sang. There was a yellow chalk cross on the floor under the aquila. Each veteran had a backpack or rucksack and a weapon by their feet. My heart ached. This was how it had gone over 2 decades before, when they came to the service, young and fresh and eager, before the war. Before the horror.
"Let me try. Try to give them a chance," I said.
"Gregor,"
Midas hissed.
"Let me try. For their sake. Cover me."
I slipped into the back of the hall, my gun lowered at my side, and joined in the verse. One by one, the voices died away, and bowed heads turned sideways to look at me. Down the aisle, at the chalk cross of the altar, Lund, Traves, and a bearded man I didn't know stood gazing at me. In the absence of other voices, I finished the hymn. "It's over," I said. "The war is over, and you have all done your duty. Above and beyond the call." Silence. "I am Inquisitor Eisenhorn. I'm here to relieve you. The careful war against the blight of chaos that you have waged through Urbitane in secret is now over. The Inquisition is here to take over. You can stand down. Two or three of the hunched veterans began to weep.
You lie, said Lund, stepping forward.
I do not. Surrender your weapons, and I promise you will be treated fairly and with respect.
Will we get medals?
The bearded man asked, in a quavering voice. The gratitude of the God Emperor will be with you always. More were weeping now, out of fear, anxiety, or plain relief.
Don't trust him, said Traves. It's another trick.
I saw you in my bar, said Lund, stepping forward. You came in looking.
Her voice was empty, distant. I saw you on the tannery roof, Omin Lund. You're still a fine shot, despite the hand. She looked down at her prosthetic with a wince of shame.
Will we get medals?
The bearded man repeated, eagerly. Traves turned on him.
Of course we won't spake, you cretin. He's here to kill us.
I'm not, I began.
I want medals.
The bearded man spake, screamed suddenly, sliding his las pistol up from his belt with the fluid speed only a trained soldier can manage. I had no choice. His shot tore through the shoulder padding of my storm coat. My bolt exploded his head, spraying blood across the rusty metal eagle on the wall. Pandemonium. The veterans leapt to their feet, firing wildly, scattering, running. I threw myself flat as shots tore out the wall plaster behind me. At some point, Fischig and Midas burst in, weapons blazing. I saw three or four veterans drop, sliced through by silent needles, and another six tumble as shotgun rounds blew them apart. Traves came down the aisle, blasting his old service-issue las rifle at me. I rolled and fired, but my shot went wide. His face distorted as a needle round punched through it, and he fell in a crumpled heap. Rex and her fire teams exploded in. Flames from some spilled accelerants billowed up the wall. I got up, and then was thrown back by a las shot that blew off my left hand. Spinning, falling, I saw Lund, struggling to make her prosthetic fingers work the unmodified trigger of Traves' las gun. My bolt round hit her with such force she flew back down the aisle, hit the wall, and tore the Imperial Aquila down. Not a single veteran escaped the Guildhall alive. The firefight raged for 2 hours. Rex lost 5 men to the experienced guns of the Sameter 9th veterans. They stood to the last. No more can be said of any Imperial Guard unit. The whole affair left me sour and troubled. I have devoted my life to the service of the Imperium, to protect it against its manifold foes, inside and out. But not against its servants. However misguided, they were loyal and true. However wrong, they were shaped that way by the service they had endured in the Emperor's name. Lund cost me my hand. A hand for a hand. They gave me a prosthetic on Sameter. I never used it. For 2 years I made do with a fused stump. Surgeons on Messina finally gave me a fully functional graft. I consider it still a small price to pay for them. I have never been back to Sameter. Even today, they are still finding the secreted, hidden bodies. So very many, dead, in the Emperor's name. That was Missing in Action by Dan Abnett. Read by Toby Longworth.